I'm D'Melo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. Madness, pain, ear-cutting despair, desolate poverty. Van Gogh's myth tells the tale of a melancholic martyr who took his own life in an ultimate act of revulsion. By contrast, to follow the evolution of Van Gogh's works is to go from darker shades to the discovery of light and explosion of pure pigments. So begins one of the opening panels in the introduction hall that welcomes visitors to Beyond Van Gogh, the immersive experience. It just opened up at the Oregon Convention Center and runs through January 9th. Here, visitors get to know biographical details of Vincent Van Gogh and his place in the art world. But there's so much more. Stepping toward me is Fanny Curtat.
Oh, hi, Fanny.
Oh, hi.
Hi, I'm D'May.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi. Here's my elbow.
Oh,
sorry.
Nice to meet you.
She's an art historian who's finishing a PhD in contemporary art.
We started October 2020, so it was very much a pandemic project.
Curtat has been a consultant and art historian for the creative team at Montreal's Normal Studios, led by French-Canadian creative director Matthew Saint-Arnaud.
And it took 6 months about to create, which, considering everything, went by pretty quickly. And so it was a process of finding the images, finding our footing about how to create this type of project remotely too, and Zoom, and finding all tricks and ways around the pandemic and thinking about how these projects can come to life still in a pandemic setting. And so it was very much this balance of finding the right artist, finding why Van Gogh, why at this time, how is it relevant, and also what can we do with it? What's the middle ground between the traditional aspect, the essence of the work, and the transformation that can help move the story forward?
This is my first in-person field-recorded interview since the pandemic, and one of the few outings like this that I've had. Surprisingly, the masks we're both wearing don't seem to muffle the sound.
I would like to do a walkthrough, but just describe where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. There are three rooms. The first room is the introduction hall, where people can read a little bit more about him, read his quotes, which are just a treasure trove of information and insight about him. So people can get to know him a little bit better. And then that, on the other side, would be the waterfall room.
Curtat takes me into the waterfall room.
So what are we seeing in the waterfall room?
So the waterfall room is really a portal. So it's really sort of a small space just to prepare people as they walk. Because if we were to walk this way, you walk against the movement. So it's sort of preparing you for, you know, the unsettling effect of having things moving around you to avoid too much vertigo. And this space was all about giving free range to the animators to see how, with their tools, how the pixel can interpret the pigments and really have this dialogue of Van Gogh and what they could do and letting the inspiration go free range. And so you have this impression of stardust, you have this impression of movement, you have the vitality of a pixel, the way a pixel shows light, the way he tried to show light.
As you leave the waterfall room and then enter the immersive room, you see with the eyes of a child as you continue to adjust to the movement that engulfs you. To say Beyond Van Gogh is a series of multimedia projections of about 200 of Van Gogh's paintings belies the immersive quality of this experience. Imagine being at a museum when suddenly all the paintings grow so large they engulf all four walls and the floor, with you in the center of a swirling prism of color and light. At first, it can be a vertigo-inducing experience as the music enhances the out-of-body quality of stepping into Van Gogh's works. This is Beyond Van Gogh.
Not like his work was melting, but like it's a flow that we're entering. We're entering a flow that's really unlike a traditional exhibit. That's really about combining these two tools. That's really about this dialogue of his pigment, his style, his brushstrokes, and what these projectors could do, what these animators could do. So it's really preparing you in more ways than one. See the texture in the back here? You have sort of a grainy, orangey, red, brownish texture in the back. That's from one of the back of the paintings.
That's a lot of detail.
Yeah, and I think it was great for them to have a creation, like a free-range carte blanche sort of creation process where they could be inspired and do what they felt like his work was. And it's just really this flow, this movement, this brightness, this color, but also this sort of softness to it.
It really is theatrical.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it should be. I feel like people sometimes, you know, the average time a person will spend in front of a painting in a museum is usually 10 to 13 seconds. But when you spend more time or when you have an experience like this that forces you to a certain set amount of time, then you really go in depth into the work and you create this connection. And again, hopefully people will first go to the museum and second stay longer than 10 seconds in front of a work. For example, again, Starry Night. If somebody knows Starry Night, well then if they are in New York and they go to MoMA, they are in front of the real thing, they are most likely going to spend more than 30 seconds in front of it because they feel like they want to appreciate it. And I'm hoping that this type of experience creates that, a will to appreciate his work differently and to see just the value of color, the intensity of color. That's what he wanted to share. You know, he failed as a preacher, failed as an art dealer, and art was really his last resort to communicate, to help. He wanted nothing else but then to help others. And he was very awkward with it. He was not very good with people. And it took him time for him to figure out what his purpose was. And it's only in the last 10 years of his life that he started painting. And mostly the last five, mainly the last two. And then the last 2 months of his life, he painted, I think, 70 paintings. So there's this urge to communicate. And what he wants to communicate is what we see without knowing, voir sans savoir, is just these bright colors, this movement, this intensity, this nature that is filled with life, this healing quality of the sun, of nature. And so that's the beauty of his work. That's why also it's so relevant.
You know, so much of what you said really shows me that if you're not distracted from the things that we are in modern society right now, how much you could commit to this kind of work.
Yeah, and the irony is that we're using sort of modern tools to show also how to appreciate older pieces of art. So I think that's why the dialogue is important, because these technologies are here to stay. Instagram is here to stay, will probably be replaced by TikTok or something else. And so the way we experience images is changing, but it's all about creating a bridge. It's all about not replacing one for the other. Like the museum is key, seeing an original is key. But then having these tools provide a different access point to this work is also pretty amazing. And maybe it's a new way of connecting with different audiences and getting kids interested in art history. I stumbled upon art history. I was already in university. It took a while for me to just encounter the sheer possibility of that field. And so to have children be aware of it in a playful way, in something that might be interesting to them, where they can run, where they can just experience it freely, I'm hoping that also it creates sort of this spark for them to just look into it more eventually.
It's really an incredible thing because, I mean, this room is how big?
The whole experience varies from location to location, but the whole space, including the two previous rooms, is usually about 25,000 square feet. And so this obviously is a bigger part of it. But yeah, I couldn't tell you the exact square footing of this room, but it is massive. And it's really to give you this impression that you're entirely surrounded by it, that the floor is taking you with you. And it's a great opportunity when you see the exhibit with kids inside, especially in the scene we're in, where they're just following the brushstrokes, following the light flowing around them, twirling with the colors. It's just magical.
Yeah, because I wondered how you could make the experience like seeing the actual painting. And it sounds like there's sort of a beginning, middle, and end to each one of the paintings that are featured.
The whole show has different ways of organizing each scene. So in some scenes, you're going to have a composition. They're going to be more static, sort of also to give the eye a rest so that it's not too disorienting. And then some paintings are going to have a focus on them and just really explore the universe. Of course, Starry Night, it would be almost cruel to do an experience like this without Starry Night in it. And so it deserves this focus. But you have other paintings that were chosen to also be just in the main light and to have this experience of, for example, when we have Starry Night at the Rhône, which is another painting, you sort of have this impression of what it would have been like for him to be surrounded entirely by this landscape.
Would you read this quote that's on here?
It is difficult to know oneself, but it isn't easy to paint oneself either. And you could hear it also in French while I was talking. So throughout the experience, you have quotes in French and English, and they are read inside the soundscape in French, English, and Dutch, which are the three languages he wrote mostly. I think he also spoke a little bit of German, but in this correspondence, it's mainly these three languages, yeah.
How do you say it in French?
Il n'est pas facile de peindre les autres, mais Dieu sait qu'il est difficile de se peindre soi-même. Something like this, I think.
Yeah.
That was very good.
Thank you.
So now we're seeing, would you describe what we're seeing right now?
So now is a very, very endearing scene to me because this is the self-portrait scene. So the whole show sort of follows a bit of a chronological order in the sense that it's not meant to feel that there's a beginning or an end, but there is this progression from his earlier period, which is much darker when he was learning, doing like Millet, like Delacroix. And then as he gets to Paris, discovers the brightness of the Impressionists. And as he gets to the South of France, this explosion of color that we know him for. And then Auvers-sur-Oise, just this wild movement and texture. But this scene is more anachronical in the sense that when you put all of the self-portraits that he did together, you have a sense of how wildly different the different phases of his life are. You have a sense of what he went through. And these are particularly important by the fact that we only have one photograph of him. You can see it in the show always, but you only have one photograph of him. So this is really the only way we have of knowing what he looked like throughout his life. And if you look at this particular painting, it's a painting of self-portrait with bandaged ear. And it was, of course, did right after the ear-cutting incident. And you can see on the portrait that he has his ear covered with a bandage. And that's to say to his brother, I am healing. Behind him, you can see a white canvas. That's to say, I am working. And on the other side of him, you have a Japanese woodblock printing, which is to say, I am inspired. And so this whole self-portrait was to say to his brother Theo, I know I scared you. I'm okay. I'm recovering. I'm going to be fine. Don't worry.
I don't think a lot of people realize that Impressionism really owes a great debt to Japanese woodblock paintings.
It was a massive influence for them. It was like a revolution in the way that they could see the world could be represented differently. The surface, the light, the flow. You can see it particularly in the movement of Van Gogh. You'll see it more, I would say, graphically almost, iconographiquement, I would say in French, with the almond blossom scene, for example, where you have this idea of one surface and the breath of it. In French, we say le souffle. And you see that a lot happening in his work. For them, it was so revolutionary to step away from the studio art that was happening at the time. It was worth fighting for. They were all struggling artists because of that, because they were willfully doing something that was not popular at the time. They would not do a Venus coming out of a shell or a bright scene of Hercules or Aristotle or something. They wanted to show the world the way they saw it, the way they felt it. And that's what also they saw in Japanese woodblock printing, this breathe, this the way it breathes and this souffle, this breath throughout the surface is just, yeah, revolutionary.
I had the fortune to be able to go to the actual Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam and actually see the brushstrokes and look up close. Of course, not all the paintings were there, but, you know, a good majority of them. But one of my questions was, how do you recapture that experience? And in some ways, this is sort of enhancing that experience, isn't it?
For me, it's really about thinking of complementary experience. Never in 100 years should these experiences be seen as any form of replacement of the aura of an original. There's nothing like the magic aura of an original. And I'm not the one inventing the word aura. It was Walter Benjamin, one of famous art historian who said it, and I think it encapsulates the experience very, very correctly. But when you have an experience like this, it's a trade-off that can be interesting because you don't have often the opportunity of seeing multiple Van Goghs on the wall unless you're in Amsterdam. And you get to choose and tell the journey of his work in a whole different way. You get to choose from over the 800 pieces, oil painting that he did, and 2,000 pieces if you add the watercolors and the drawings. So it's really a great chance to tell the story differently and provide this sort of fantasy of going through the frame. Because I'm like a kid when I see a Van Gogh on a wall and I want to touch it, and I have to fight with my inner self not to touch it. And when I'm experiencing his world like this, it feels almost like a dream. There's something surreal about being in a space surrounded by a brushstroke, sewing them enlarged like this. So you don't see the texture, you can't feel it, but you see it and feel it differently.
Right now we're in Exhibit Hall E, and this whole space is being occupied by different manifestations of the same painting, I guess, you know, and it's almost like it's being painted mm-hmm. as we're talking right now, and mm-hmm. we're watching that. It can be kind of an overwhelming experience, I think, and I'm glad you have some benches here for people to sit on.
Exactly.
But it, you know, I do have some vertigo issues, but I really love the way that it's engulfing us in just a swath of so many colors of this, usually the same painting, but of multiple paintings also.
Exactly. You see, the scene we're in right now is like a collage of different pieces of the artwork where he signed, where we focus on the fact that he signed Vincent. It's touching. He didn't sign a lot of his work, but the fact that he did with his first name is touching. And a scene like that is meant to show you that, but also to give your eyes a little bit of a rest. So you don't have this turbulence in this scene. It's not moving besides the signature slowly appearing across the room. And it's really finding this balance of, I would say, turbulence and movement and feeling like it's vibrating. And these movements sort of rest. After the twirling sky of Starry Night, for example, you have this little bit of a breath time before the next image comes on. So it's all about finding the footing and giving the audience a little bit of a chance to follow us on this journey.
Yeah, his signature is kind of different in each one of these paintings, too.
Yeah, and what's unique, though, is nobody signs with his first name. But to be fair, he was living in France, and I can say this as a French person. We are not tremendously good at pronouncing names, especially Dutch names. And so he wrote himself, like, just write Vincent. They can't manage my last name. And so Vincent it is. But it just makes him all the more endearing. And it's actually so rare in art history to have that much information and insight on one artist. And the correspondence with his brother Theo was everything for him. It was his emotional support, his financial support. And so he confided in him in a way that's incredible. I've never seen an art historian specialized in Van Gogh that doesn't end a conference by being teary-eyed at some point. He's just incredibly moving. And that's why for me it was so important to start the experience with his words. Because even from my standpoint, I knew more about Van Gogh than most, of course. But starting this experience, I went in depth into his correspondence, and that's when I got why everybody was teary-eyed. That's why I got the emotion. And so that's what we thought would be a great hook for people, to see that there's more than the ear-cutting incident, more than the mad genius. You don't have the mad genius aspect when you look at his work. And so that's what we wanted to focus on.
Well, it is very tragic that he was never really recognized in his lifetime.
He was getting more and more traction, though. You have this wonderful article of Gabriel Aurier, one of the French critics, and he says that he's an alchemist of light, a genius of colors. And then you have Vincent's reaction and the brothers in the letter to his brother, where he's like, I need to write to him. I need to settle this. He can't be talking about me. So he was getting traction, but he was not dealing with it great. And also, he passed away, he was 37. Chances are, had he been alive, he would have had probably the same recognition as Monet and probably the same wealth. So what we need to remember here, and she doesn't get nearly enough credit, is the fact that Theo passed away 6 months after Vincent. And so Johanna van Gogh-Bonger, Theo's wife, was left alone with this baby, hundreds of paintings from this eccentric brother-in-law, and she took it upon herself to get this work showed And no, she translated the whole correspondence. She showed everything while creating a boarding school to have a living for her and her son. And when she passed away, she gave everything to her son, which is Vincent's namesake. So the baby was called Vincent van Gogh. And when he passed away, he gave everything to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. If it wasn't for her, we might not even have all of this today.
And the incident, of course, is
the ear incident, notoriously famous. We could not avoid saying a word about that. And here we have sort of the follow-up to that. We have a panel called A Little Room with Weller Green Curtains, which is after the ear incident. He was very much aware that something was wrong, aware that he needed help. He was much more lucid than people think. And reading his correspondence, you see that. And that just showcases the fact that he knew what was happening. And so he willfully walked to the Saint-Paul Asylum and just committed himself to it. And in this little room with water green curtains, he painted Starry Night. And that's one of the most, I would say, telling, compelling fact about him and how much it resonates with us today, especially after the pandemic, when we were cooped up inside. He was cooped up inside. He was working with his own demons in crisis. And through all of that, through a barred window, painted Starry Night. He could come out, of course, and he would walk around. And Starry Night is not just the exact view from his window. It's very much a composite landscape of his experience of the place. But it's just incredible to have this amount of hardship and yet focus on the beauty, focus on sharing the joy and his healing process. It was healing for him.
I'm sure as an art historian that you've probably thought about this, the relationship of mental health and art, and perhaps his response to it was the best therapy he could do.
And there is undeniably therapeutic aspects to art. It's a branch that's being explored, I feel, more and more, art therapy. And I'm glad also because there's this other movement, Art Brut, which is outsider art, I would translate it. And that's is really showcasing people who are on the fringe of, I would say, the canonical art history. And they are just working from a brute point, hence the word in French. And he was sort of working from the same space, this sort of inner energy, this inner flame that was just driving him. It was really a drive, and you can feel it in the texture, in the impasto. You don't have somebody applying thin coats of oil painting over and over again. It's really a gesture that's impulsive, that's quick, that's intense. And that's also a big, big part of his work. You can feel this intensity, this sort of frantic need to just showcase what's in front of him and share it.
Incredible story, incredible. And do you feel that people get a lot of that out of this experience?
Okay. In the introduction hall, they have a chance of getting most of it. There are texts that explain everything. The texts also focus on what's relevant. What can a 21st century audience connect with this 19th century production? And so you have these texts, you have the quotes, and then they can come in. So whether you know a lot about Van Gogh or you don't, you have some tools to either get more, or if you're like my husband and never read anything, you can just come into the main room and just experience it a different way. In Quebec, we have an historian of art that used to say, voir sans savoir, look without knowing. And that should always be the standpoint for any art experience. Just look and feel. And so you also have an opportunity to do that. You don't need my words.
Right now, we're in a series of portraits, his potato eater period, and his most realistic or realism period, portraits of actual life that he experienced.
And for him, it was really about learning. By the way, it's a particularly important phase for here because the Portland Museum of Art has one piece from this period, the ox cart. And so it's a very touching period because you can see that what he wants to represent is rural life. He doesn't want, from early on, he's still copying like masters like Millet and Delacroix, but he doesn't want to show a Venus or Hercules or a Julius Caesar. He wants to show people who are working the soil, eating potatoes, who are peasants. He saw beauty in them. So you might see a portrait and you might wonder why he would do basically a woman that has almost like witch features. But that's because he saw beauty in the lines in her face. He saw beauty in these gnarly hands of the potato eaters. And so it's a very important scene for me.
And so how long is in this particular hall do the paintings or the exhibit rotate?
So the loop in which we're in is about 35 minutes. The whole experience takes about an hour. It depends of how much people want to read. Most of the time, people stay for more than one loop because they feel like they might have missed something. Sometimes you don't even feel like you've seen it twice. And the whole loop doesn't feel like there's a beginning or an end because we don't know when people will walk in. So it's really meant to be this flow, this journey through his work. And so it's meant to be really organic in that way.
I love that there's a painting of the windmill and the windmill is actually moving.
And you know what I like about that scene is that it's Paris and not the Netherlands. He was in Paris and painted Montmartre, but Montmartre at the time was filled with windmills. And so it looks like he's painting home away from home. It feels like it's just nostalgia. And the moon, the room we're in right now, well, the scene we're in right now, you can see the influence of the impressions already. You can see how bright it is. It's not yet the brushstroke that you'll see, for example, in Starry Night. It's still very much reserved, much closer to a Monet, almost a pointillist approach. But you can also already see just the brightness of it, the importance of it.
When you look at some of this and you see the use of actual brushstrokes, do you think that people will feel like they're actually painting with Van Gogh?
I think some scenes feel more like that. When you feel like it's being applied when you look at it, definitely so. I think that for a scene like this, the one we're in right now, where you have a gallery of portraits, and I don't know if you can hear, but sometimes you hear like the click, giving the impression we're in an attic and the light bulb is just being turned on. And so just to have this space of memory for him. So here it's less about the movement, but more about the presence of the work. And so some of them will wink at you and you have just this whimsical impression of presence to show the community of people that was around him. For example, the lady here with the green background, that was his mother. And here you have the postman who was his friend. And so it was really, it just showcases the community of people that were around him. He couldn't afford to pay for models, and so he painted the people around him.
And sometimes he paid people his bills, you know, paid his bills with portraits too.
Yeah, and he could manage, you know, he actually had more money than we think because Theo was sending him quite a hefty amount every time, but he wasn't very good at managing it. Everything went into material, everything went into colors and canvas. And sometimes the money wouldn't come quick enough and he would use his tea towels as canvas. Yeah, desperate times.
Which paintings did he use as tea towels?
I don't know, actually. Oh, okay. But when you go inside the waterfall room, just okay. The portal behind you, you have texture of one of the canvases, the back of the texture. People don't necessarily know that and they don't need to just feel this impression of texture, and that comes from there, yeah.
So what's next after this exhibit in Portland, the Van Gogh exhibit in Portland?
So yeah, it's meant to keep on traveling. Van Gogh is going to keep on going across North America, South America, and hopefully also other destinations across the world. And so, yeah, we're hoping he's going to keep on going.
Would this kind of exhibit work with other painters as well?
Well, we already work on another project that usually I don't necessarily talk about unless it's coming to a city, because I don't want people to have false expectations, but hopefully it'll come here. But we have a Monet exhibit that we started in Toronto, and yeah, we are starting to think about other projects too.
It'd be nice if maybe the Japanese woodblock paintings could get this kind of exposure.
That would be lovely. There are so many things that would be great in a box like this. Personally, I would love a Georgia O'Keeffe exhibit to have these beautiful landscape of New Mexico with the bright colors that she saw in that desert. The flowers, I think it would be incredible. So sky is really the limit here.
I really think personally that, you know, going to the museum and seeing the actual painting is of course the most important way you can see a work of art as it was painted.
Definitely.
But I also think for younger generations, this kind of in-depth exposure in a multimedia presentation can encourage and inspire.
That's what I'm hoping, because, you know, these tools are here to stay, like I said. We might as well sort of use them and stop fighting them. What can they bring to the experience that we have of art? You know, Instagram, for all of its flaws, it's very much criticized. The art world is by no means a unified front on these questions, and nor should it be. It's a mixed bag, and that's what it's for. It's about debates, and it's about questioning what we're going through. But I am sort of glad to have Instagram and to have a view, sneak peek of what's happening at the Tate Modern, what's happening at Fondation Louis Vuitton in Japan. So there are ways in which it can be interesting, and I think we need to explore them. We might as well do, because Van Gogh is an easy fit for this type of experience. Maybe he can connect to a wider audience that would not have been interested in it otherwise.
Well, I think we've covered a lot. Yeah, is there anything else that...
No, it's if you have anything that comes to mind. But yeah, otherwise, it's been a lovely chat.
I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, it's likewise.
And thank you for being my first field recording interview.
Yeah, am I?
Since the pandemic.
Oh,
yes.
I'm glad. I'm happy. We're going back to culture and life. Thank you.
So thank you for being on stage and studio on Arts Watch. Fanny Kuta.
Yeah, thank you very much. My pleasure.
You can see Beyond Van Gogh, the immersive experience at the Oregon Convention Center through January 9th, 2022. Hours are Monday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. During the holidays, it's 12 noon and 10 p.m. on Thanksgiving and 12 noon to 6 p.m. on Christmas Day and 10 p.m. through 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve. And we have all those details at stageandstudio.org and orartswatch.org, where you can also find photos there and more information. Masks are required, and there are other requirements you might want to check out. The venue will allow up to 200 people to view the experience at one time, so I recommend going during off hours to make social distancing easier. But all in all, it was worth it. As a lifelong Van Gogh fan, it was definitely beyond Van Gogh, and it was definitely an immersive experience. That's it for this special Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. Till next time, I'm Dimelo Roberts.